This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 14th. So, if you recall, we were about to start talking about socket programming. We call it socket programming because that's the API. In fact, what we're doing through those sockets is we're using the network protocols that are implemented down below in the operating system. And I just have two slides here, one about UDP and one about TCP. It should be obvious at this point that the characteristics of the underlying protocols show through the socket. So when you're programming with UDP sockets, they behave like UDP, unreliable datagrams. When you're programming with TCP, it's going to behave like the underlying protocol TCP, reliable stream transfers, and the necessity for the client to contact the server first. Mohammed. So, with that as background from the main textbook, we will now turn to the auxiliary textbook about programming TCP IP sockets in C and get into the details of this. There are some additional slides in this Kuros and Ross slide deck about socket programming. They refer to programming with sockets in Python, and I really want to go through this at the level of C because that's where the interface are to this, and you need to sort of understand what's going on at that lower level to be confident of what you're doing at with higher level interfaces. So that's why I do C in this class, and also why I insist that you do the first programming project in C. After we do the first programming project in C, then we'll move on to a point where you can program in languages that are more comfortable for you, that have better support for not making mistakes than C does. But it's sort of important to understand, especially when it comes to the aspects of cybersecurity and all the problems that exist around networking and cybersecurity, why that is. And by looking at the C interfaces, you get a better sense of what the source of those problems. Okay, so with all that as background, let us click through to there. And this first little part is a little bit of review. We've talked about this. The Internet Protocol, the network layer protocol of the Internet, is a datagram or packet protocol. It's a best effort service. Packets may be lost, reordered, duplicated, delayed. It's sort of, as programmers of the endpoint, you have to be prepared to deal with all of those things. Remember that the purpose of the network protocol is host to host delivery. We need to add something else in order to get application to application delivery. Okay. So with IP version 4, which is the version that we most commonly use today in the internet, IP addresses are 4-byte numbers. And as a convention, the way we write down those addresses, and you've seen these, is that we write the 4 bytes separately in decimal with periods in between them. Why? That's just what they decided to do. Okay, so the hex value of these things doesn't matter a whole lot. It has consequences later on when we talk about addressing, about routing But for the time being, you can just think of these as sort of arbitrary four-byte numbers. Machines that are, or hosts that are on the same local area network as your machine will have similar prefixes in their IP addresses, but they will each have a distinct IP address. So if you're on the WSU wireless network, I think the addresses start, what, 121 dot, Andrew, tell me. 134.121. Sorry, he works for the ECSI IT folks, and so I know he's very familiar with these things. So I'm not really picking on him when I just say, Andrew, tell me. okay. So and then as we saw before, the DNS system allows us to translate the human sensible names into these IP addresses. Now, one little bit that we often gloss over and usually doesn't matter a whole lot, but in some contexts it does, is that the IP address really identifies a specific interface on the host. Remember, a host consists of a bunch of stuff and may have many different physical interfaces to the network. An IP address corresponds to just one of those physical bits of connection to the network. And, you know, most of us don't have our machines on multiple networks at once, but there are machines that would have to be, like routers, and there are other machines that are it's convenient that they be. So, really, the address corresponds to the interface, not the host, but we'll not worry about that too much. Okay, so the transport protocols, again, review. The best effort service from IP is not sufficient, nor is the fact that we can't address applications. So on top of the network protocol, we have the transport protocols, common ones being UDP, User Datagram Protocol, that retains the essential nature of IP itself, that it's best effort. It adds a data checksum to make sure that packets that are delivered actually with high probability have the same content as what was sent, and they add a port number. TCP turns this into a reliable byte stream protocol, does flow and congestion control, and also has port numbers. Okay, so that's the transport protocol. So what are these port numbers? As we said earlier, port numbers are 16-bit identifiers. Okay, they're numbers that get put into the transport layer header. Go back and look at the chapter one animation of how headers get added to packets. They get put into the transport layer header, and when a packet arrives at the destination machine, the transport layer there will interpret the port number in figuring out what socket it should put the data into. Remember, socket is an operating system level thing. Port number is a network protocol thing. And they're in close correspondence, but they're not the same. Okay, so how do you speak this? We've seen essentially this diagram before. Applications talk through sockets, which may be TCP or UDP, and then through the operating system, we get down to port numbers and TCP. The applications have to give the operating system some clue about what port numbers they're wanting to deal with, and that's part of the socket API. Okay? We're just going to talk about sockets for programming with the internet, but sockets are also used for other protocols, other networking protocols, and also on Unix machines, something called Unix domain sockets, which are entirely within the machine and don't go over the network at all. So if you're looking at something like, I think, D-Bus, the sort of, what would you call it? Data repository service
that's used in some Linux systems. It will talk to the applications over Unix domain sockets. We'll just talk about using them for networks.
The reason it's important that you know that the other things exist is certain tools that I'll be showing you will be showing us data about non-internet sockets. So that's the reason. Okay, so now we're ready to make a socket, or at least talk about making sockets. The way you make sockets from an application program is to make the socket system call or C library call. So we're telling the operating system we want one of these objects to be made called. And that means the operating system is going to allocate some storage to represent the data structures. And we've got to tell the operating system what kind of socket we want it to be. I said there are many kinds. And so this socket call takes several parameters. And the way you read this table is that these are the, if you want TCP, this is what you do. And if you want UDP, is what you do for these three parameters. Okay? So, first thing, the family of the socket is going to be INET, standing for internet, right? And the PF here stands for protocol family. So we want a internet family socket. And the type we want is either a stream socket, in the case of TCP, or a datagram socket, in the case of UDP. And then, although if you're using TCP and UDP, there's sort of no choice from that point for the protocol. With other families, there may be a choice for the protocol, given the type. Right? So stream sockets will always be TCP sockets, and datagram sockets will always be UDP sockets. Right? Clear? You're just telling the operating system what you want. Okay? And what you get back is, in Unixy systems, a file descriptor. And that file descriptor can be used with other file system calls, like read and write, as well as the networking system calls, like send and receive. And in Windows, you get back a socket handle. And that socket handle cannot be used for other for things that expect file handles. Right? So that's one difference. You have to be careful about that. Okay, so now we have a way to make a socket. Next thing. Let me skip ahead one slide, two slides, three slides. we'll come back to that other one. So we start by looking at what happens on the server side. So the sequence of system calls is going to be different depending upon whether we're playing the client role or the server role, and we'll start with the server role. So you might expect that on the server side we need to create a socket. We do, and we say that it's a stream TCP socket. Clear? Okay. The thing to notice here is that these system calls return either the socket identifier, like a file descriptor or handle, or they return -1. And you must always check to see that the system call has succeeded before you go on and do other things, assuming that it's a good result. Right? If in your projects you don't do that, we will be taking off credit, because that's not proper use. Even if the program works, it's not proper use of the system calls to accept their results without checking them.
without checking that they're valid.
Okay, and in the example code provided for the book, they take a very brutal approach to what happens when the system call returns negative one. They just say die. Right? That's fine. We're not going to talk about error recovery from these things in this class, but you must check.
Okay.
So we're going to look at this one next, but before we do, I need this slide to motivate that first slide that I skipped over a few moments ago. Having created the socket on the server side, we have to say what port goes with that socket, because after all, our client has to be able to find our server. And the only way the client can find the server is to say, I want to connect to that server on some port, and the server had better be on that port. So the next step on the server side is to do a bind system call, which is right here. And you pass in the socket, and all of this garbage here is the way we represent the address of that's associated with the socket. And so now I have to go back and show you that other slide, right? Because that other slide is about what's this business of addresses? How did they represented in your C program? Okay. So, addresses. What do you think might belong an address for the internet? Well, clearly the address is going to have the port number in it, but this interface actually allows us to include the IP address as well as the port number, and an internet sock adder structure, in other words, a sock adder underscore in, that means an internet socket address, consists of the family, the port, the IP address, and then a bunch of space that isn't used. Now, why a bunch of space that isn't used? Well, the unspecialized socket address, remember sockets can be for lots of different uses, they need addresses too. And so there's this generic one that says it starts with a number that is a address family, and then there's just a certain amount of space, 14 bytes. Okay? So that's the generic version. The one we're always going to be using in this class is the sock adder in. And where next? So diagrammatically, a sock adder consists of a family that's 2 bytes, and then just a blob of space, 14 bytes. Okay. Now, any other set of addresses you use is going to have its own specialization of this, but from the point of view of what gets passed across the operating system interface, because C is so impoverished as to its ability to express types, we just have to essentially say that it's a socket. It can't check that we're really doing it right. Okay, so the generic one is the blob, and the internet version starts with the family. That's how we tell that it's an internet one. Then the port, the 4 bytes from the address, and the 8 bytes that are attached. Questions about this? Yeah?
Why are we using unsigned longs for a 32-bit address?
Why are we using an unsigned long for a 32-bit internet address? That's the convention. Okay? Long here means 32 bits. Okay. As the operating system interfaces have evolved, if you actually go in and look at the header file days, it doesn't probably say long there. It says unsigned 32 or whatever it is.
But it really is 32 bits.
Okay?
It's just the header files have evolved, but this is what it will mean.
All right. So now we've got, now we understand what, oh, what those look, oh. No,
not quite yet. I'm not quite sure why they decided to make this a struct instead of just putting this unsigned log here directly. It has the programming consequence that when you want to talk about this field, you have to say your adder dot sin adder dot s adder. An extra level of naming.
Maybe just to maybe they did it just to remind people about a little bit.
There aren't other things within that struct that they're not showing?
No. No, because it really needs to be. It really needs to be. I bet there's a historical reason for that. I bet that
in the olden days when internet addresses were thought of as being made up of a certain number of bytes of network part and a certain number of bytes of host part, there may have been additional fields in there for dealing with that.
These days we've gone to a more flexible scheme where that wouldn't work. So, all right.
So, what's not shown here is that EchoServe address is
what kind of struct?
What do you think the type is for EchoServe address?
Nope. Look, it's got some fields in it, right?
You can already tell that it's got to be a struct. Its type is struct sock adder in,
right?
It's an internet. It's a data structure representing an internet adder, which goes by the name struct sock adder in. The family, the first two bytes, address family internet. S adder field. Notice here. So now two levels of dots, right? The struct sock adder ins sin adder dot s adder is a value that represents any internet address. It happens to be zero, but we always write it using the defined constant in adder underscore any. And then you might wonder what this H to NL business is about, and we'll get to that. But just think of it. Think of this as being, think of this as just logically representing, the whole thing representing any internet address. Okay? And from the server's perspective, that's fine, because what we're saying to the operating system is give me a socket on my host. I don't know what its IP address is. You do. So please take care of it, you know. So, right. Okay, and finally, we have the port field, and we pick a port number, and I don't remember what they picked for this one, but they picked some number. It's pound defined somewhere in the header fields. Hopefully some of you at least went off and retrieved the code that goes with these examples. I asked you to do that last time. Anybody do that? Okay, you will follow along better if you have that code in front of you. So at least get it today and go back with these slides and look at it and understand where these different things come from. Because there are a lot of names here that are not defined in the code that I'm showing you. They come from header files. If you can figure out where that is. All right, so we set up our struct sock adder in, and then we pass it to the bind system call, identifying the server socket that we made before, and notice how we cast it to a struct socadder star. It was a struct socadder in, but the bind call is generic, and so we have to say, well, get rid of that specialization and just treat it as a plain socadder, and then you'll have to figure it out on the other side. Okay, and you have to say how big that data structure is. All right, so software engineering hats. What are the problems with this interface from a software engineering perspective? Anybody want to offer some opinions?
It's written in C.
Well, there are consequences of it being written in C, but what are the dangers associated with this interface? Anybody? Yeah.
The server is required to accept a new connection.
No, I'm not thinking about anything about the networking. Just from a pure programming perspective, what are the dangers here? Well, here's one. This second parameter takes the address of something and casts it to struct socadder star. What if this weren't a struct socadder in? What if it were something else? There's no checking, right? Sort of, we take the address of something and say, treat that as a struct socadder pointer. No checking. Danger, Will Robinson. You know? Okay? Second thing. One of the things that system calls, I don't think bind does it, but other system calls do this. They may fill in fields of one of these data structures that's passed. And so it asks you to tell it how big the thing is that you're passing. That's right. It doesn't know how big it is. You have to tell it. What if you get it wrong? Danger. So this is what I mean about wanting you to see the C interfaces, because problems like that are the source of lots of mistakes that lead to security problems, functionality problems, and so forth. And you've got to be aware that can happen if you're to understand all the possibilities about how programs using networks can be built with bugs, okay, and not build bugs into yours. Questions about this? All right, so the server has now created the socket, bound it to a port. Do I need to have my discussion about bind as an English word? Okay, so bind is an English word that means to tie, right? And that makes sense here. We're tying the socket to a port. The past tense of bind is bound, right? So after we've done this bind system call, we have bound the socket to a port. There's another English word, bounded, that isn't the past tense of bind. Okay? Bounded means limited in. So your function is bounded above by one or something like that. Because bound is a different English verb that's related to bind, but it has a present tense present tense sense as well. So, why this? Because when you're speaking professionally to people about the socket interface, you've got to be using the right words, or they'll think you're a fool. Okay? So, after we bind the socket, it's not bounded, it's bound. Okay? I hope that's helpful. I don't want to insult anyone, but I hear enough mistakes that I go over that. Yes.
So the binding of the sockets is, of course, consistent. It doesn't disconnect at all until the connection to the internet is pretty much ever.
Okay. So the question was, this is a persistent binding of the port. And the answer is yes. Once we do a bind on a port, if we try to do another one, it will probably say already bound as an error. But the binding is a purely local action. Right? It's just a matter of a conversation between your application and the operating system. Okay. Operating system, just put that port number into that socket, please. Okay. That's all that happens. No network traffic happens. Yeah?
Does the physical socket change on the binding? Like, we assign the port number on
the So you make sockets with the socket call,
okay.
You bind them with the bind call, and you can't change them once they've been bound. Okay? All right. Yeah, another question. Good.
Only one socket pro. So pretty much it's just one to one. And
actually, you can have multiple sockets associated with the same port. It leads to non-deterministic behavior, and so it usually is not done. But there are uses for which that is done.
And the answer to that question probably also depends on whether you're talking P sockets or DP sockets. Just to confuse matters further. And furthermore, actually, as I think about it now, with TCP, we're going to see in a moment that there may be many sockets associated with the same port number. But not for this purpose. That'll come later. We'll get there. All right, so now we have a socket. It's got a port associated with it. And the next thing that we do is say to the operating system, okay, operating system, I, application, am now ready to have you start supporting me in talking over that port. That is, start allowing people to connect to that port. Okay. So that's the listen system call. Whoops. There it is. Listen. Okay, so you say, listen, you pass the socket, and you say, how many connections should the operating system be willing to have that I, the application, am not yet servicing? Right? Because clients out there may reach out to the host and say, connect to this server, and the operating system has to know whether it should let people sort of pile up and sort of wait for the server to get around to them, or if it should just insist that that the server sort of keep up with the connections themselves. This doesn't really enter into very much concern these days. I think we just tend to pass this constant max pending and let it go at that. Might be something like 5 or something. Not a big deal. But you must call listen. Okay, so once listen has been called here, it's possible for a client to make a connection at the operating system level to this. The application won't see it quite yet. That's what happens in the next step. So,
The next step on the server side is the accept system call. It takes a socket as its first argument, and it takes, what do you think this is? What type does that have? Think back to bind. Cast a struct sock adder star. When we cast something to struct sock adder star and passed it to bind, what was it actually? It was a struct sock adder in, an internet sock adder data structure. Same thing here. We pass that to bind, and we pass the length of that thing that we're passing to bind. They're attempting to be safe, right? They're making you say how big it is, but they're not protecting you against your own lies. Okay, so we call accept, and the behavior of accept is to block the process that calls it until a client comes along and actually connects to the server. So accept is the first one of these system calls that we've seen that will actually cause a process to wait. Everything else is entirely local, right? Make a socket, bind it, listen. Those are all just entirely local actions by the client and the operating system. This one says, I don't get past this point until a client has actually come along and asked to use this server. Okay. And why do we pass this struct sock adder in and its length to accept? Well, the server client code may want to know who the client is. Okay, so the operating system conveniently fills that in into that data structure. Before we turn. Notice again that we check to make sure that it really succeeded before going on. And notice also that there's a variable here, client sock, that is returned by accept. And so here's the magic, part of the magic of this API. We have the server socket. It's in listening state. When a client connects and we accept the connection, we get back another socket, different from the original socket. And it's on that socket that we're going to do the sends and receives or reads and writes that actually transfer data to the client. And this is now coming back to that earlier question about multiple sockets with the same port number. This client socket shares the port number with the original socket. And it knows that it's talking to a particular client because the client socket is actually associated not only with the port number but also with the IP address and port number of the client. Right? So when messages come in, the lookup that's done to figure out which socket looks at the client IP address, the client socket number, the server socket number, and the server address. Okay, it's called the TCP portal. And that's used to choose which socket it's going to get data. All right, so there's accept. So how do we get out of accept? Well, now we need to look at the client. Okay, so what happens on the client? Do a socket call just the same as on the server side. There's no difference. But now instead of binding, we do a connect system call.
passing the socket, passing the address of the server, and it just succeeds or fails.
Okay. So it either returns zero in the case that all is well, or minus one in the case that something has gone wrong. So that's establishing the connection. That's the thing on the client side that will cause the server to get past the accept. And now both the client and server can talk to each other. That's back on the server side. Now the client and the server can talk to each other using the send and receive, R-E-C-V, receive, pronounced receive, system calls. Those take the socket, the buffer that you want to pass, essentially a set of bytes, and the length of the buffer, how many bytes, and they take this last argument as a flag, a set of flags that we will always pass as zero, so we won't worry about that too much. And that causes a data from the buffer to be passed into the operating system, which will then convey it onto the network. When send returns, what has happened? What is the requirement for send to return? It's very simple. The data has been passed into the operating system. There's no guarantee that the data has been passed onto the network or that the data has reached the client. Simply that the data has been accepted by the operating system, and the operating system promises at some time in the future to send it over that connection. Notice also the check here that the send system call has done what was expected. The return value from the send system call is the number of bytes that the operating system accepted out of that buffer. And the usual behavior is that the operating system will block the send call until it has accepted all of the data. So the usual behavior is that the return value from send will equal the amount that you asked it to send. There are some exception cases that can be triggered where it won't do that, where it will only have accepted part of the data, in which case it's called a short send. But I don't think we're going to do anything in this class that could possibly trigger a short send. But if you're doing anything that involves interrupts, that can interrupt a system call that's blocking, then it is possible that there would be a short send. Okay? So, just a bit of warning danger there. All right? So we send, and we receive. And notice now that the receive happens not on that socket that the server originally created, but rather on the socket that was returned by accept. Danger. We pass the address of a place for it to store the message. We pass the length of that buffer. if that buffer isn't as big as claimed, overwrite something else in your program. Now, here's another danger. We're going to talk about these things multiple times because it's hard to absorb all of this really quickly. The receive system call most definitely may return less data than was asked. So I say, you know, put some data into Echo Buffer, and the maximum amount you can put in there is this much. And it may well return and say, I put one byte in there. Okay? Okay. There's no guarantee whatsoever that you will receive as much as you asked for. And that's a good thing, because you actually know what the server is going to send. So you could end up sitting there waiting for a very long time for, what the sender is going to send, because you could wait for a very long time for a sender to send something that it wasn't supposed to send. Your guarantee is that receive will, if there's actually more data to be had, it will return a positive number. If the socket has been closed at the other end, it may return zero, and that's how you find out that the server has nothing more to say. And if it returns minus one, of course you've had an error. So those are the possibilities. So you go back and forth doing that. The client sends, the server sends, sort of in whatever pattern that they is established by the application level protocol. And then finally we reach the end and we use the close system call to close the sockets. Missing semicolon on the right side. Now, if you forget to close the socket, and you have a simple program that just does something for a while and then the program ends, of course the sockets will be closed when the program ends, just like how it's going to be. But if you have a long-running program that has a lot of sockets coming and going, and you don't actually close them, you will eventually run out of sockets. Not a good thing. So, what I need you to do next time is go off and study the order of the system calls on both the client and server. This should become second nature, that the order of the system calls on the client is what? Socket?
Connection.
Connect?
Communicate?
Close. Right? That's the socket side. And the server side is socket? Bind, listen, accept, communicate, close. Right? That those sequences need to become second nature too. Okay. And so by next time, guess what? Clicks questions. Clicks questions times about stuff like that that I talked about today. Andrew. Guys, quiet. Somebody's asking a question. Not in C. The C++, Python, C Sharp have libraries that take advantage of their stronger type capabilities to sort of help you through this and not make mistakes. But the C type system really hamstrings you. And I think what people probably have tried to do, you know, make me a TCP socket, make me a TCP socket, make me this, that, the other thing, and different libraries have that in it, but everybody's done it on their own. There's no standard around that. So the fundamental system call interface is what it is. And it sort of has to be, because there isn't any type checking across that. What?
Seems limiting.
Well, no, it's not limiting. It's just dangerous.
Okay.
You can do anything. You can do many things that are not legal, as well as all the things that are.
Thanks, guys. See you Friday.